You are listening to the Wells Tech Podcast, where we talk about technology that can serve the church and its work of spreading the gospel. Wells Tech is a part of the Podcast Network on Streams, the internet media site sponsored by the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Join the conversation by visiting our podcast website at wellstech.wells.net. You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast for Wednesday, March 31st, 2010. This is episode 125, Going to School on the Internet. Welcome back, everybody, and thanks again so much for joining us on the Wells Tech Podcast. My name is Martin Spriggs, and I'm very privileged to have a little bit of a different format today. This is our normal classroom technology episode, and as usual, we have Gail Potratz, our semi-regular classroom technology correspondent from New London, Wisconsin. Good morning, Gail.
Good morning to everybody.
How are you?
I'm just fine and anxious for the celebrations of Holy Week, especially, of course, Easter.
Yep, absolutely. And so also with us, and I kind of feel humbled here because I've got, I believe, two of the leaders in their particular fields, Gail, you in classroom technology, and we have with us Jim Grunwald from Dr. Martin Luther College in the field of academic computing and specifically distance learning. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Martin and Gail.
And we've had Jim on the show before in different capacities. I think we've interviewed you a couple times, and Jim is filling in because we have Sally still down in Mississippi helping with different things going on with her father's illness down there, so we keep Sally in our prayers and wish her a speedy return as well. But thank you, Jim, for joining us, and we'll do this in a similar fashion. We have our discussion topics, and we have just general conversations. And Gail, you obviously know this, you know the score there. So let's jump right in. The discussion topic that we kind of thought would be helpful to have Jim and Gail talk about would be what we're calling internet-based delivery of education content. That's kind of a long topic for a fairly straightforward concept, at least, and that is there's so much stuff, you know, on the internet related to the classroom that could be delivered in the classroom via broadband, because I think more and more we're seeing classrooms that are better and better wired, so they've got the ability to get this broadband content in. But that's pretty much the easy part. It's determining what kind of content we want to bring into the classroom that really I think some teachers maybe struggle with. Gail, you've been dealing with this at New London. How do you approach internet-based delivery of educational content in the classrooms there? I assume that your classrooms are wired there and you've got different things like streaming video. How do you coach your teachers to make use of that?
Okay. Well, I took a little different slant at this, I think, maybe. I wasn't looking so much at the content as the delivery system itself.
Well, let's start there then. Sure.
Okay. And so we talked last week, or last time I was on, about things you could do with content from YouTube and that type of thing.
Sure.
And this kind of reverses the process. Now I'm looking at how the content that's out there and the content that we create ourselves, how do we easily deliver that to our students using the advantages of the internet? And
so give me an example, Gail.
Okay, I've given you for the show notes the link to our my own eighth grade class page, and particularly you could look anywhere on there, but I'll just take the example up in the top left hand corner. I have a link to the language arts wikis, and if you would go to that wiki page, which is just a wiki page that's been connected, linked to our final web website, our eighth grade website. And on that page, I have contents for, well, let's say, we just finished the quarter here. Let's say the third quarter book review. So there's a tab for that. And when kids go to that tab, linked to that wiki page, I have the directions for the book review, the rubric that they'll that I'll use to grade the book review. Oftentimes, depending on assignment, I'll have links to different web pages where kids can go and look at examples or find reference material.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever the assignment is and whatever the components are, they're all linked. They may be videos, they may be text documents, but they're all linked together on this wiki. And I find that delivering content that way is really handy. Number one, once it's done, it's done.
Sure.
I have that there. I can use that. I maybe modify it, but I have all my components there online for most everything that I teach in language arts.
And so this is something you've done just this year, or you've been able to reuse the content now?
I've been working on it for a couple of years. And
okay.
When we get to the second part, talk about curriculum, I'll tell you how it's connected back to the curriculum, which mm-hmm. is kind of a neat feature, too. Of course, another really positive thing with this is that when kids are absent, they have the
right.
content right at home.
Sure.
And even if they're on vacation in Florida for a week, they could be doing that if they wanted to.
So are they primarily consuming this content in class or at home or both?
Both.
Okay. So you introduce it, you kind of lay out the roadmap for where things are, what they're used for, and then they have 24/7 access to this, whether it be in
right.
class or at home, if they're wanting to do review, study for a test.
Right.
Do they contribute themselves in this model?
To this point, they have not, other than their own projects. You know, when it's a special project type situation, like they did some vocis for one book report, and then, of course, that page where those were all shown was connected, so
mm-hmm.
you know their own work at the end of the project is often shown. But no, it's a great idea, and I've thought about it, but so far I haven't really worked that in.
Mm-hmm. And how do you see this kind of delivery mechanism playing itself out in the day-to-day lives of the students? Are they more engaged? Are they is this kind of old school now, or they're kind of eager to look at these resources because it's dynamic, it's the internet?
It's a typical classroom, you know, so before
they
we
only get
the test,
so excited. They only can get so excited, right?
Right. And remember, they're in eighth grade.
Right.
So they're thinking about other things.
But yes,
no, they're actually quite motivated. And I had one student that said to me, I put a final vocabulary test, and I wanted them to, it was an online test, and I was going to give it to them online, so rather than have them go to this site, I hadn't used it before, I just put it way down at the bottom of the wiki page for the short story unit.
Right.
And I did it late that night, and I was going to use it the next morning at 9 o'clock, but somebody, one of the kids found it and took the test himself before we took the test.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, more power to them. I put things on there. I didn't really intend that to be used
sure.
that way. But it showed me, hey, some people are looking here for these things, and they're using them. They're going back to listen to the story again if it was an audio story. Do a lot of those. I think they are. I think they are motivated. They all, as we've talked about before, I'm able to pretty much do one-on-one computing this year with my eighth grade class. And so all having access to a computer all the time, all day long, is pretty significant.
Oh, I can imagine.
When you do this kind of delivery.
Sure. Jim, you're in the college classroom, but I'm assuming you're leveraging online content within
right.
the context of those classes or the other professors there?
Sure. I appreciated Gail's example of working with online content and getting access to it on the elementary school level. At the college, we're making use of the course management system Moodle,
right.
which then allows us to do much of what Gail is talking about, but then obviously beyond that, since we could do completely online courses through that method too.
Mm-hmm.
But many of our faculty at MLC, for the regular face-to-face courses, they have done what we would refer to as web-enhance their courses, in that they each have a Moodle site for their specific course or even separate sections of the same course, and then the professors will upload the course syllabus, various assignments, discussion boards to continue discussion outside of the classroom and so on.
Right.
We also then will have practice tests, things of that sort, so students can themselves ready for the actual test that might be given in a traditional format,
mm-hmm.
or it might be given online as well.
Right. So the logical next question is, how has that transition gone for other faculty members? Either, you know, in your school there, Gail, if other faculty members are indeed using this method, or there at the college, what was the process that I assume both of you were leaders in this area? How did you get that incorporated into kind of the mindset of that's how you do that's an important part of the classroom now?
Well, I think in my case, it's a lot of modeling, as with most of the things we do. If people see someone modeling something successfully, it's not quite so painful to them.
Right.
But this is definitely a big chunk, even for faculties that have been doing things with computers for a while. The whole internet delivery of courses and the way to organize things
mm-hmm.
isn't something, it's a lot to bite off at once, and so I'm constantly telling people, pick one course, you know, one class that you teach, and work on just one class during the year.
Right.
You know, don't just try to take it in smaller pieces. And we kind of, how I brought this on, and you'll see, if you go to look at this place, you'll see that I've been working on it for 2 years, but the faculty here, really, I just presented this to them at the beginning of this year at the 1 20-minute in-service that I had before school started.
Wow.
So, yeah, not a good thing, but that's how it was. And if you look on the, I directed you to the elscurriculum.wikispaces. That's in the show notes as well. And if you look there, you can see how I tried to bring it about. We have a curriculum page and curriculum for technology curriculum. I've been talking last year about the 21st century skills and trying to introduce that whole concept to the faculty. So we went through the 21st century skills and kind of tried to make them our own, broke up into committees and took all the verbiage and tried to come out with, I said 8 points, but they had 10 and they wouldn't condense it anymore. So we took 10 points. And then each of those 10 points, the numbers, it's a wiki again. And so this is a wiki that everybody can contribute to because mm-hmm. we're all building. But everybody eventually, you can see all the 21st century skills, and then each teacher has their own wiki page down the column on the left. And what you're doing is, for example, I'll say the book report project I mentioned before, just for an example. If that book report spoke directly to the skill of oral communication, mm-hmm. then I would pick out whichever point that fit under, and I would put it there. And then the beauty of the system is when you give a little brief description of what your project is, you also link it to your other wiki that you use as a classroom wiki.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. You've got your
sure.
beginning of a curriculum, so to speak, and you're correcting it to your real world examples on your own pages. So the two of them mesh together.
Uh-huh.
And so that's a huge thing. To do that. So mine is barely started. I've been chipping away a little bit this year,
mm-hmm.
but I think I'm the only one that's really got much on there yet at this point. But we'll be talking about that in June at our in-service again and hoping to get a little farther.
So it's more, so this was not a mandated approach, but basically a presentation of a way to enhance the educational experience, and then you're hoping that through modeling and, you know, keeping this in front of the faculty that, you know, some will kind of latch onto this and take advantage of these approaches, these tools.
Well, that all depends on the administrator's
sure.
viewpoint on that, you
right.
know. So I'd say some of both.
Okay. Okay. Fair enough. Jim, how about you?
At MLC, we've been using Moodle now probably for about 5 years, and before that we used Blackboard, which is also a course management system. The move to Moodle was because Blackboard was pricing everyone out of the market.
Mm-hmm.
Moodle is open source code, so it's free for any schools to install and make use of. In fact, a number of our Wells High Schools have Moodle installed, and some of our elementary schools do,
mm-hmm.
Too. As far as getting our faculty to use it here, it's similar to what Gail had described. We do have some in-service training for them that's optional, usually in the spring of the year, but sometimes in the fall also, just before the courses are ready to begin. Also, I make a point of surveying the faculty to see who is using Moodle and which aspects of Moodle they are making use of. I usually do this on an annual basis.
Right.
And then I publish that information for the rest of the faculty so they can get a better idea of how their colleagues are making
great idea, yeah.
And we probably have about 70% that are making use of Moodle in their regular classrooms, which is just great.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the students will put some pressure on some of the faculty to make use of it because we can have up-to-date grades in particular courses that the students can access. So we get a little help from the students, too.
Sure. So what, speaking of the students, how are you kind of preparing them for this model going out, you know, in their first call or early in their ministries, getting into the classroom to take advantage of these? Are there classes that help them, instruct them, educate them on how best to use these tools?
Well, with the freshmen, when they come in, we have an orientation session for them, and I will introduce them to Moodle at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then if various instructors are making use of it, they will also mention it in class or, you know, bring it up on the smart board or the screen to show them where to find materials as well. Otherwise, for our regular students, we do have a 2-credit computer applications course that they take their first year here to sort of get everyone up to the same speed as far as the use of various software applications.
Mm-hmm.
And students are given the opportunity to test out of that entire course if they already are very familiar with those particular
right.
applications, or they can test out of parts of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that we're working on at MLC is sort of revamping our Gen Ed courses. And one thing that we're pushing for there now is to get another 3-credit course into the Gen Ed curriculum for teacher track students. And this course would probably be taken before they went out student teaching, so probably about the junior year.
Mm-hmm.
And it would concentrate more fully on integrating educational technology into teaching.
Got it. Yeah,
make sure
right.
they're really up to speed. So hopefully we can, you know, get that to become a reality in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
Also with that, we're looking at introducing a minor in educational computing, which would be an elective area for our students. Currently, they can have elective areas in math or social studies or science or bi-ed and so on. But in the past, we haven't had one in educational computing.
Uh-huh.
So we're trying to put together a 15-credit minor. This would be approved by the state of Minnesota, so it would become part of their teaching license as well.
Uh-huh.
So currently, we're in the process of getting all of that together, and hopefully that will be up and running by next fall as well.
That sounds exciting, which is kind of a nice segue into another exciting program that's launching this summer, right? The CET program?
Right. The Certificate of Educational Technology program will officially begin this summer. Some students in the past have taken some courses that will apply for it. First of all, what the program is, it's designed for teachers that are already in classrooms. In other words, they already have a teaching degree.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to give them an opportunity to take various courses related to technology and education, and then to package them together in what we're calling a certificate. A certificate at various institutions is usually a non-degree granting
right.
program. In other words, it's not like a master's program, but many of the courses that we will have in it hopefully will be then can be, will lead into a master's and will count towards working on a master's.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of courses are part of this program?
For the program, it will have 15 credits, and there will be two required credits in the program, making up six of the credits. One will be on enhancing the curriculum with technology, which again is how to use technology effectively in the classroom. And the other one will be on teaching online. And with the advent of courses being offered over the internet and the wide use of technology and online courses within our schools, we feel that this is an area that our teachers out there should become more familiar with. And we're always looking for more teachers to help teach online courses, even between the high schools. And there's been some preliminary discussions about online courses within the upper grades, the grade schools, too.
Mm-hmm.
Besides the two required courses, there are a series of elective courses, 17 courses, actually. Some of these are three-credit courses, some are two, some are only one. But students would select 9 credits from that batch of 17 courses. And those courses vary greatly as far as what they cover.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be courses on smart board, multimedia in the classroom, both audio and video, digital utilities for online apps or for Web 2.0 applications, remedial technologies, digital music, technologies for the younger grades. We have a course on technologies for preschool through second grade. Photo manipulation, of course, is a topic that teachers should know about. So we're approaching that through several different courses. We have one that will be looking at open source software for doing photo manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have another one that concentrates specifically on using Photoshop Elements and Premiere Elements. We'll have other courses on web page design and construction, as well as designing and constructing school and church websites. Other courses on publication creation, things like school newsletters,
sure.
Different things that schools might be putting out. So a whole variety of courses. And we came up these courses by polling teachers and pastors out there about 2 years ago and asked them what areas they would like to receive courses in.
Mm-hmm.
And then we built the program based upon the feedback we had received from them.
So it sounds like these are extremely practical type courses that maybe teachers, you know, that are at Emmanuel in New London, you know, would look at to say, I need to get a little bit smarter in some of these classroom technologies. I'm going to take a course or two, or go all the way and get the certificate, not necessarily to prep them to be the technology director, you know, of the school, but just to better use the technologies that are on the scene today to enhance that educational experience.
Right. That's a good point. We are not trying to target the technology person at the school, but rather the general faculty so that they can better make use of technology within the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also courses there that a technology coordinator of the school would be interested in.
Sure.
As well.
Sure. Now, I know Sally is teaching one of those courses, correct?
Right. Okay. She'll probably be teaching one or two of them. Her courses will not be up this summer or next fall yet, but we have her slated to help teach in the area of web design and construction.
Mm-hmm.
She's done some great work with Final Web, so to pull that material in as well.
Absolutely.
Other people that would be teaching for us, Joe Dufour of Fox Valley, will be teaching a number of courses.
Mm-hmm.
We're hoping that Gail will be able to teach courses for us as well, especially in the area of digital utilities and Web 2.0. Dave Bauer will be teaching a course for us in digital music.
Oh, sweet.
And one thing about these courses is that all of them will be offered in an online format, so no one has to.
And it's exclusively online, right? It's not in. None of these are in person, correct?
Right.
Okay.
We will probably be offering some courses that could be taken in a face-to-face format. For instance, we do have some smart board training courses out there, And people could take it in that format, or they could take it in an online format. Mm-hmm. But you're right, the entire certificate could be completed via online.
Okay. And the cost for this is a regular credit hour that would apply to any other degree online degree program or class?
Right. Okay. That is correct. The information on the certificate program can be found at the MLC website, www.mlc-wells.edu. And then within that area, people can simply go to academics, and then there will be a link to certificate and certification programs.
Okay.
And there you'll find brochures and all types of information on the program, including the application form. And people don't have to apply to the program. They can simply take these courses.
Sure.
But we thought it might be nice to let people package them together and then receive a certificate for that work.
Is there any kind of prerequisite?
Teaching degree currently is the only prerequisite, but anyone can still apply to the program. I'm sure there are pastors out there that would be interested in a number of these courses too, and they definitely could find courses that are there.
I would even think there'd be school secretaries who do newsletters, those kinds of things that might be interested as well.
Right. There's certain courses there that could apply to anyone who's making use of technology.
And are you taking registration now? Is it over? What's the timing of all that?
Right. Registration is online through the MLC's website, the Office of Continuing Education, and they will have a link there. The registration is in with the registration for regular summer courses at MLC.
Gotcha.
And if people access the information about the certificate program, there they will find more information about how to register as well.
Okay.
Maybe I should mention for this summer, the five courses that are being offered are teaching online, which is one of the required courses, designing and constructing online courses, which is a three-credit elective, multimedia in the classroom one, which is on audio. Joe DeFore will be teaching that online from June 14th through the 25th. He'll also be teaching Multimedia in the Classroom 2 video as an online course from June 28th through the 29th. And we will be having a smart board course online. Joe has that. I also have been asked to do a smart board face-to-face course in the Watertown, Wisconsin area sometime this summer. Don't have the dates nailed down on that yet. And also Dave Pelzo will be teaching in face-to-face course June 14th through the 19th on campus here at MLC.
And that's
well.
Smart board, right?
Correct, smart
yes,
board.
Right. Yeah, I know we had him on the show a long time ago talking about smart boards. Seems like these are accelerated class schedules, you know, a couple days, couple weeks, so they're not like a 7-week commitment.
Right. Our summer school usually runs twice as fast as a normal semester. The 2 3-credit courses, teaching online and designing and constructing online courses, those will be a full 8 weeks this summer,
right.
But it's completely online, and we spread it out on purpose. So those will run from the 14th of June through August 6th. The other ones, Joe DeFore's 2 1-credit courses, those are spread out across a 2-week span of time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And again, simply because they're online, and they're online in an asynchronous format, so everyone does not have to log in at the same time.
Right.
In other words, they're sort of daily lessons to get done, but you can work on those anytime when you have time during the day or the week.
Sure. Good. That sounds exciting and a nice, I think, a very positive step for MLC to be making in this area. And I'm sure I speak for teachers who really maybe are just searching for these kinds of things, and certainly within a Christian context, this has got to be better than going to your local community college, but understanding that this is for the sake of the gospel and, you know, use the tools that are available.
Right, and the instructors obviously have been in the classroom or are in Wells' classroom, so they fully understand needs and limitations of our Wells schools.
Absolutely, yeah. Before we jump maybe to our next segment, which is ministry resources, and Gail, you have any wrap-up on this whole internet-based delivery conversation? Any final closing thoughts there?
No, not really. I think we covered everything I had thought about.
Okay. There's a lot of stuff there, and I think we'll obviously be talking about this more and more, but I guess I'm getting the sense, and Jim and Gail, you maybe are hearing this too, a lot more interest now than ever in trying to incorporate online content and how best to do it and looking for lesson plans and how to integrate it nicely as opposed to the good old days maybe where you had the computer lab and typing lessons and very basic stuff that kids are way beyond at this point, and I think we need to be smarter about how we incorporate this content into the day-to-day classroom activities.
Right. That just reminds me of as a finishing comment here. I'll tell you about it was just Friday, last Friday. I had an hour-long, 45-minute-long English language arts class, and what I did is they had their regular test on the short story unit that I normally would give with the vocab and some facts and a few essays. But then we took a whole day, and I gave them a choice of two different topics. And gave them the whole time to work, and it was divided up kind of, I wanted to see how they would remix the information. They could use all their notes and anything, and the internet, anything they wanted to. So they had to remix some information, but then they got their pick. They were to decide on which internet content delivery system we had used during the year would be the best one to use to communicate that particular information.
Yeah.
It was wonderful. It was totally quiet the whole time. They were just totally absorbed. And that, you know, it's a beautiful thing. You just walk around and you watch them work. And we had four different representations. Some did blogs, some did wikis, some did voice threads. And what was the other one? Oh, we had a person use an iGoogle site.
Okay.
So four different things. That was wonderful. They are becoming very, very, very capable, even in eighth grade, of seamlessly, you know, meshing the content and the delivery service together.
Very nice. Cool. All right. Great conversation. Good stuff. And we'll look forward to seeing how that class runs and some of the other courses that are offered over time. Let's move on to ministry resources. One thing that I wanted to share was a blog post that I came across that I think will be valuable to anybody, any church especially, who's running a Facebook fan page. That's a question I get quite a bit these days is, you know, should our church have a Facebook page? And if so, what kind of page? You know, should it be a regular page? Should it be a fan page? And what are the advantages and disadvantages of both? But up until now, there was never a great way to gauge their effectiveness. For websites, yeah, you could use Google Analytics and apply that, and you get some good statistical feedback about how many visitors were coming, how they were arriving there, if they were using search terms, if they were going directly there, where those visitors were coming from, what geographic location, what towns, which is all available through Google Analytics. But somebody came across a system or a process that you could apply to Facebook that would allow Google Analytics to be applied to Facebook fan pages. So you get the same kind of Google Analytics statistics for a fan page and determine how many people are visiting, what they're looking at, those kinds of things that you can for any other website. So I'll post a link to this in the show notes, but you know, I've long said it's not really worth, you know, using some of these online communication tools like Facebook, like just a regular web page, without knowing their effectiveness. You could be spending a ton of time, ton of effort, even money, and really be a poor steward of those resources because nobody's going. Nobody's looking at the things that you think they're looking at, and this is a great way to kind of either validate what you're doing and maybe even refine it to make it even a little bit better by taking a look at a specific page that you thought maybe was getting, you know, nice traffic, but ultimately is not, and maybe you need to change things up. So I'll put a link to this blog post, and it's fairly straightforward. There is some geeky stuff you have to get involved with as far as the what they call the FBGAT, the Facebook Google Analytics Tracker It's a little tool that you have to put in place, but ultimately it is fairly straightforward, and I think once you get this in place, Google Analytics, anybody that's used it will tell you that it's a great tool for really evaluating how well your website is doing at its prescribed purpose.
Martin, you are so timely with that information. That is just great information for us since our
You're starting a Facebook
Emmanuel,
page?
Our Emmanuel fan page will go online later today or tomorrow.
You'll get it installed because then you'll know.
Yep,
absolutely.
Now I better do that before I put it out there. So,
exactly.
Yep, I'm just about ready to publish. I'm pretty excited about it. I delivering sermons on there as well as on the website. And hopefully some Bible classes before long. So I this will be great if we can track it and see if more people are looking there or on the web.
Absolutely. Let's move on to our picks of the week. And Jim, we prepped you a little bit that if you were a guest on the show, at least for a full-time guest for the entire length, you'd have to come up with a pick. And I think you have. What's your pick this week?
I thought it was a privilege to come up with a pick instead of an obligation.
Some feel both ways, yes. Well, I'm glad you feel it's a privilege. So we have high expectations of your pick now.
Oh, okay. my pick is GIMP, which is a digital editing program. And the reason I chose GIMP, at MLC, of course, we teach the students and the faculties of photo editing and looking for programs that they can use to do that. In the past, we've used Microsoft Photo Editor and Microsoft Picture Manager, and then we used Paint.net for a while, but its problem, again, was it was only PC-based. So it's looking for something that would be cross-platform, and GIMP fits that bill. Some of our area Lutheran high schools are making use of GIMP as well, so some of the students then do come in with some knowledge. GIMP can be found at gimp.org, and we can include in the show notes too the link to that. And GIMP is a very powerful program. It's completely open source, so it's obviously affordable for any of our schools. It is known sometimes to have a steep learning curve, and yet the basics of making use of it are quite straightforward as far as cropping images and resizing them, changing the resolution, things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my pick of the week.
Yeah, I've used GIMP, although we have standardized here, at least in the Senate office, on Photoshop. So GIMP is obviously a competitor, you know, and not really even a competitor because they're not after dollars. But I can't find too many differences as far as the core functionality of Photoshop versus GIMP, which says a lot because Photoshop is kind of the industry standard.
And people have often compared GIMP to the capabilities of Photoshop.
Exactly. And you mentioned a steep learning curve, but the nice part about GIMP, like Photoshop too, is you can go on YouTube or you can go online and find all kinds of video tutorials that will walk you through many of the features, which is really nice these days. I can't think of 5-6 years ago before we had that kind of thing and people willing to post screencasts of how you do different things, having to trudge through PDF files or the manuals that came with the software to try and figure out how to do very simple tasks. But a quick search now really nets you some wonderful results as how to use some of these software products.
Right, and GIMP itself has an excellent online manual that is then interactive to jump to the proper location. Also, we can attach to the show notes. I have a 6-page manual that I made up for the students on the bare basics of working with the program.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, very good. Cool. And GIMP is one of those that I think would be the subject of one of your summer quarter classes,
right?
Right.
It's not being offered this summer, but it is on the slate for sometime in the future. And along with those courses, something I didn't mention before, I do want to put up on our website so the students in the certificate program will be able to indicate which courses they would like to see come up next. So we can sort of offer courses that the students are really interested in.
Very good. Thank you. Well done, Jim, for a rookie. Now, Gail, what's your pick this week?
Okay, well, I decided with my pick to be very traditional. I picked a book, actually. I think this is the first time.
A paper book?
Paper book, hardcover or soft cover.
Oh, okay.
Or right. I guess you could make it technology and read it on your reader, too. It does come as an e-book.
Okay.
it's called Socially Networked Classroom. Socially Networked Classroom. And I just decided to take a read, and this is an easy read, because in all the talk about technology and all the talk about social networking, you know, it used to be like when we first started to initiate a lot of technology, it was like, oh no, how are we going to find the extra time for that? And, mm-hmm. and now pretty much we're getting pretty much to integrate it finally where we're not having special classes just for technology.
Mm-hmm.
And now the thing is like with all the social networking, people are integrating that in their classrooms, but me included, a lot of people are wary of that. Do we really want to do that? Do we really want to get, you know, because we have all the protective, you know, internet protection mm-hmm. type things that we're always concerned about too. So pedagogy still does matter. That's the bottom line in all of this. And in this book, if you read this book, you'll see some ways that people have used some cool social network tools in order to get kids networking with each other and enhance their education, enhance the teaching of the 21st century skills, you know, connected to those skills, and have been able to produce some real cool lessons. The thing about this book, it's very practical. There's some real world activities and lesson examples, including even assignment sheets and rubrics that mm-hmm. have been designed to go with them. So it's a neat little package, and if you've hesitated to do collaborative learning, getting kids involved with blogs and wikis and even Nings talked about
mm-hmm.
All kinds of interactive media, and it also did include a unit on tips, how to do the tips for internet safety and etiquette, and you know, protected blogging sites you could use so you're not way out there, and
sure.
how to make your own little circles to, you know, so you're not, you're social, but you're not out there where you can be preyed upon by just any person in the world either.
Right.
So, very practical. They suggest grades, anybody, any teacher in grades 5 through 12.
Ah, okay.
They suggest upper grades. For the book.
Very good.
Yep.
Yeah, the problem with some of these books is they get outdated. It sounds like this book has some good foundational principles, but still has captured some of the later tools like Ning and those kinds of things that makes it more, you know, very practical for the teacher of today.
Right. I think people often think of Facebook and Twitter, and I actually am going to use Twitter finally in the classroom. I just feel like it. I just want to see if I can get something good out of it for mm-hmm. the classroom.
Yep.
I know people do. We're just going to use it for a collecting data kind of thing. It's pretty cool when kids, you put it up on the smart board or the screen and you see the feed come through, and you see once you pose a question, you see all the, you know, people that answer that question, and you can make a graph to graph that information, and it's mm-hmm. kind of a neat research tool, I think. We're going to try it for that aspect.
Cool. Well, we'll have to pick your brain on how that went.
Yeah.
Very good. My pick is a software pick called Phrase Express. I wrote a blog post on this not too long ago. For a while, I had been using this is a free application as well, but I'd using a very simple application called Texter. I've talked about that on the show in the past. Basically, it's a text replacement program. So you type in a series of characters, you hit a special key, and it gets replaced with the template of, or boilerplate of whatever else that you wanted to replace it with. So one area that I use this on is signatures. So I've got kind of a lighter signature that's more for reply emails, and I have a full signature for new emails that has the Wells logo. I have a personal email signature, and what I do here with Phrase Express, it just runs a little bit in the background, you know, a little application that runs in the background, and once it notices that I've typed, you know, M tilde or whatever it is that I've got as my, you know, leap into action character, it replaces that one character or three characters with whatever I want it to replace it with. I often get the same question on different things that the Synod does as well, like our web hosting program or what I would recommend for you know, church audio or video, where I've got some templates built that I share kind of the same information and context with, and I've got some shortcuts that are available there too. Just a huge, for me, a huge time saver. For any, if you type anything more than once, you know, this is probably a worthwhile thing to put on your computer, called Phrase Express. It also has some other cool features like multiple clipboard items, so you will remember the last, you know, however many 10, 15, 20 pieces of content that you put on the clipboard, so you can go back and retrieve those rather than just the one that you would typically get. It does program launching, all kinds of other stuff. This is all free. There is a paid-for version, but I found that the free version does just exactly what I needed to do. And they've even got a little application in there that'll tell you how many keystrokes you saved. And actually, you can put in, you know, what you make per hour, and it'll tell you how much money you saved by not typing in all those letters each time. So kind of a cool application. So you can go to your boss and say, look at how much I saved you. Right. So that's Phrase Express. I think it's phraseexpress.com. We'll put a note, link in the show notes. Moving along, we'd like to highlight an upcoming event. We've been talking about it for a couple weeks now, but it's almost upon us, and that is the chapel dedication at Martin Luther College. And Jim, I'm sure you've been excited to see the progress of the chapel, and the pictures that I've seen there have just been tremendous of some of the architecture, and we saw a little bit of the streaming of the, I think somebody called it the soft launch, you know, of the right. Of the chapel, which was really neat to see all the students in there. And boy, MLC has been wanting, needing, you know, something like that for many years now. And this is just a really worthy chapel, as far as I can tell. So I'm going to be up there on April 10th, and we'll be live web streaming the that service that evening. So tune in to wells.net/streams/live at 7 o'clock Saturday, April 10th, to see all of the festivities there. And apparently there's all kinds of things going on that day and that weekend, right, Jim?
Right, yeah. They have a lot of different things going on. The MLC website, of course, will delineate those mm-hmm. for our audience as yeah. well. But, yeah, it's really impressive to worship inside that chapel. The student body, we've been in there now for about the last 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. That's got to be a real blessing to the campus there. Let's move on to community feedback, and this is normally Sally's gig, but I'm going to muddle through it as best I can. Really makes you miss somebody when they're not on the job, so it makes you appreciate them even all the more. So we didn't have too much feedback, and part of this, I'm going to turn over to you, Gail, because part of this is yours. We had an email last week from Pastor Emil Burgess wondering about good resources for internet parental controls. And there were a couple resources that came to mind. One of them was provided via Digo by Jason Schmidt. Digo is a social networking bookmark product, and I think nicely done. And he referred us to a site called, what is it, infinitelearninglab.org, which is kind of a cool site. The title of the page that I'm on is Internet Safety and You, and they've kind of created a cartoon strip about internet safety, and they use the cartoon character Garfield, the Professor Garfield Foundation, as it were, and there's kind of a whole series of animations, very well done. I went through the first one here, and they have teachers' materials, they have parents' materials. All of these seem to be extremely well done, and just another resource to talk about both online safety, but they also have a section on cyberbullying. Both are obviously hot topics for students these days, and parents as they try to protect their children from what is a very dangerous place if left unguarded. So it looks like they've got a number of things coming soon, but take a look at that site, and that was just one example of a good resource for internet safety. And then, Gail, you raised a question about, what is it, smokescreengame.com. What do you know about that?
Yeah. trying to think now if it was smokescreen or white. There's a couple of them, and they're similar. It's a game that teaches you about internet safety, right? Mm-hmm. I wondered if anyone had tried it. Mm-hmm. I got one response from a friend of mine out in Denver who gave it a look and said he wasn't much into rumors. The part of the game is rumors about
okay.
people and what they said. Yeah, I guess I'm not good enough at rumors. I don't know. It seemed kind of obscure to me. And my first look, too, that was my... It seemed like a very cool idea because it was really high-tech game-oriented. You know, a lot of internet games kids aren't interested in because they play such sophisticated games on their own. They don't really care about those little, you know, animated GIFs bouncing across the screen.
Right.
So
right.
if it isn't something cool enough, it's not going to work. And this was very, like, professionally done to teach you the dangers of what can happen when you get involved with things on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just waiting to see if somebody else does have some input for me there. I got one that thought it was a little bit too hard to find your way through.
Okay. All right. And last show, we did talk about the kidsmarts.org websites, and there's all kinds of really quality stuff coming out of the government on internet safety as well. So take a look at those. But it'd be nice to have some good Christian approaches as well, because there's obviously things that you can do on the technology side, but really what it comes down to is good Christian values being shared with
right.
the students and them adopting those and saying, hey, I am a child of God, and this is how a child of God attack something like the internet and deals with the things that are on it.
Right, and we've talked before too about the settings on the search engines, so you could,
yep.
you know, there is some parental control there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All
and
right.
I could give you a,
go ahead,
a
Gil.
Website.
I'm sorry.
I could give you another website for this is not as personally orientated as Classroom. It's called Welcome to the Web.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you that later for the show notes if you'd like. That's a
sure.
It's from teachingideas.com.uk, and we use this for our introductory material. It's a game. It's a you find clues as you go through various
mm-hmm.
units, and very basic. We use it in grades 5 through 8. We add another chapter every year or chapter
right.
two.
Sounds familiar. I think you've maybe mentioned this in the past.
Well,
it's a good
be.
Resource. Yeah, very good.
Works well. It's got good safety stuff on it.
Mm-hmm. And then we had a couple of, I believe these were tweets from Jason Schmidt, one of our Wells teachers, on a couple of really kind of cool technology tips and tricks. One is on sharing large files. There's an entire CNET article on the many different tools that could be used for shuffling around large files that are not suitable for attachments. We've talked about tools like YouSendIt and Dropbox. This gives a little bit more fuller description of those and gives some advice on what might be used best for what, and if there is a cost and ease of use, those kinds of things. So check that out. And he also talked about a new way to do mail merge. Many people are now using Gmail and Google Docs and kind of using that as their office suite. But one thing that you don't have built into those kinds of tools that you're kind of used to when you're using Microsoft Word and Outlook and kind of the Microsoft tools or other office suites, even OpenOffice, is mail merge. How do you do mail merge when you're using Google Docs and Gmail and Gmail contacts? Well, Jason came across an article on that as well, which there's a video there that walks you step-by-step through some templates that could be used and seems to work really well. I did not try this, but the screencast that was used, you know, seemed very straightforward and very usable. So if you are somebody that's gone the Gmail contacts and Google Docs route but are missing, you know, some of the basic functionality that you might get in a standalone office suite, especially mail merge, this is something that you definitely want to check out. And then finally, we heard from Shiv David, he's a member at Hope in Toronto, Canada, one of our Wells congregations up there. He asks the question, hey, Sally Martin, do you know of any good resources for electronic newsletters? And we had a couple of different resources that we've talked about. There was MailChimp, and we had a whole session on that over the summer where we did what we called bonus Wells Tech Goodness, BWTG sessions, a little 15-minute vignettes on different technology topics. And MailChimp was one of those, which does an astounding job at both crafting the list, maintaining the list, and then also providing some very cool templates for email or e-newsletters. I know a lot of congregations and schools are trying to move toward this, mostly because it's cheaper. You don't have to go through the printing process and the mailing process. If you can get a majority of your parents or congregation members to be willing to take an e-newsletter, this is definitely the way to go, and MailChimp, I think, is really well done. That's what we use for all of our synod communications at this point, and it seems to be working extremely well for us. So, Shiv, that would be a great place to start. And that's going to do it for our community feedback. Next week on the show, we have a focus on an annual event now. I think it's been running for 5 years. Called Internet Evangelism Day. It's a focus on how to use the web to obviously share and spread the gospel. We have an exciting interview with the founder of InternetEvangelismDay.com, Tony Whitaker. He is from the UK, so we get to hear that the fun UK accent. I always enjoy talking to those folks across the pond and share some insights about how it got started, what it could be used for, and where it's going. Internet Evangelism Day, I believe, is April 25th this year. So tune in next week for that. Jim and Gail, I really want to thank you for doing the show with me this week. That I'm sure our listeners could not tolerate another monologue from me.
You're more than welcome, Mark.
So, Gail, we'll have you on next month, and Jim, we'll have to have you back on again. I really appreciate your insights and blessings on that summer program.
Yeah, thank you.
We're making.
Go ahead, Jim.
I was going to say we're really, things are starting to move at MLC now, and a lot of different areas where technology is advancing rather rapidly.
Mm-hmm. And that's good to see.
Very nice. Yep.
All right, let's close the show with the music of Stephen Bautista, his song "The Most Beautiful Thing" from his album Abandon. Thanks everybody for joining us. We will talk to you next week.
Delicate bloom, and a songbird that greets the new morning. A cascading stream flowing through fields of green, and the mountains that rise up before them. And oh, so many ways, the beauty of life has shined on my face. And yet I know of one thing that surpasses by far the beauty I've seen. The most beautiful thing I know is the cross with the Savior who died for us all, and the blood that flowed from his hands and feet, and the wounds he bore so that we'd be redeemed. This is the most beautiful thing. I've stood on the edge of a grand precipice, overwhelmed by the span of creation, then sat teary-eyed while the sun paints the sky as it settles beyond the horizon. And I'm still so amazed at the beauty that life has shined on my face. But one thing stands alone, unrivaled and incomparable. Say who died for us all, and the blood that flowed from his hands and feet, and the wounds he bore so that we'd be redeemed. This is the most beautiful thing. And I'm still so amazed at the beauty that life has shined on my face. But one thing stands alone, unrivaled and incomparable, the most beautiful thing I know is the cross with the Savior who died for us all, and the blood that flowed from his hands and feet, and the wounds he bore so that we'd be redeemed. This is the most beautiful thing.